Here are the highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. Visit freetalklive.com for the full episode.
The show on Sunday ended with the earthquake where you said, "We got to get out of here. There's an earthquake."
Wasn't that amazing how it happened right at the end of the interview?
And you're here, so you made it.
Yep, we did make it. And it wasn't a big deal there. It was the first earthquake I'd ever been through. And we were sitting at the table, and I noticed the table was moving, and I thought somebody had just run into the table.
Right.
I looked up and looked at the rest of the table at that point, and nobody was standing near the table, so I thought, that's got to be an earthquake. And it was.
I slept through one when I lived in South Carolina. Now,
really?
It was nowhere near as big as that thing that you guys went through, where it was like a 7 point something.
Well, that was like 100 miles away. So where we were, according to Paul, who's one of the longtime Porkfest attendees who was there, lived out in California and Arizona, so he's been through a few of them. He said that we had maybe like a 3.
Okay. So that's about what I had lived through when I lived in South Carolina. And it was, middle of the night. I was asleep, but I remember realizing, like, it feels like I'm rocking back and forth here.
Yeah, like kind of like on a boat, almost. Not quite. A little more intense.
Yeah, well, when I think of boats, the last boats I were on were cruise ships, and you don't really
rock feel that as much
on that because they're so big.
Right.
And I've never laid down on a smaller boat. But I remember feeling, this is kind of weird. Maybe I'm just, having a weird dream. Have they already set the dates for next year?
They have, and tickets are already available.
Okay, that would be why you're mentioning tickets.
The attendees kind of ranged from, like, cryptocurrency suits to crypto hippies to the crazy kind of esoteric crowd, like, conspiracy theory, chemtrail.
You're always going to find that sort of crowd in libertarian circles.
Sure, but they're allowed to speak at Anarchapulco, right? So, like, within the speakers, you've got Ron Paul to the conspiracy theorists to the cryptocurrency professionals, and everybody's into crypto, except for Ron Paul. He's just too old for it. I don't think he's ever going to get into.
What's a computer?
Yeah, I don't think he's ever. I mean, he knows what a computer is. He uses the internet to communicate, and he does it pretty effectively. But he just isn't on board with crypto. But for the most part, like it almost felt like we were at a cryptocurrency convention because there were so many cryptocurrency sponsors that were there.
How many flat earthers were there?
There, but I don't know if they were speaking. I didn't watch almost any of the actual speakers. I saw Ron Paul speak. I watched Doug Scribner speak, who is a longtime listener and supporter of Free Talk Live, and that was it. So I didn't really see any, except for snippets of a couple others when I went inside to upload the show with the extra high speed connection they had for the video. The video booth was letting us use their bandwidth to upload with. So I saw a little bit here and there of some other folks. Let's get into what is a very disturbing story. I thought when I first saw it that it was going to be the United States, but it's actually Canada.
Oh, Canada, yes. They've got a reputation for accepting refugees, which makes this even more absurd.
So what is happening there? They're sending people back or what? What's going on?
So, a story from Al Jazeera says, despite its reputation as a haven for refugees, Canada has been deporting North Korean asylum seekers who came to the country through South Korea. Nearly 2,000 have left since 2013, according to North Korean activists, because the government says they lied on their asylum application forms. Another 150 are under imminent threat of deportation. However, the Canadian Border Services Agency told Al Jazeera it had only recorded 165 removals of North Korean citizens from Canada between 2013 and 2017. It was unclear why there's such a large discrepancy in figures. Again, North Korean activists say since 2013, nearly 2,000. North Koreans.
And the government's saying less than 200?
They're saying, yes, less than 200.
Even if it was less than 200, we're still talking about sending 200 or fewer people to their graves.
11 years ago, Tegan Kim came to Canada with his wife, daughter, and son. Now they have two more children, both Canadian citizens. A deportation would be catastrophic for the family, Kim told Al Jazeera. That notice means death to me. I came all the way here for a better life, and my family is well adjusted to life in Canada. To think we're going to be separated breaks my heart. The Joe family could also be broken up if Canada carries out its deportation orders. Two children are Canadian-born. The eldest came with his parents in 2010. The family admits they lied on their asylum application, saying they defected to China, not South Korea, to help ease the immigration process, but add they did it to escape a horrible situation.
Yeah.
Hai Kyung Jo said, I feel so desperate. It's our fault. My children haven't done anything wrong. They have to go through this separation because of us.
That's horrible.
And now let's talk about this thing to where it's easier on the immigration process to say, yes, I went to China before coming here instead of saying I went to South Korea.
What's the, I mean, not that you know, but anybody in Canada, can you explain the reason for that? Is it the Canadian government has better relations with China? That doesn't make any sense. I don't get that at all.
It's about the school shooting down in Florida. And
okay.
You got all these students who are, students of the government-run indoctrination centers being taught all about how it's all the fault of the gun, of course. Mm. He actually has them saying it's the fault of the gun that somebody was able to use. And, the bureaucrats, of course, are blaming everybody but themselves. And the important thing for libertarians to remember is the real solution is the orthodox libertarian extremist solution, which is to respect other people's right to be left alone. And immediately the public schools will be scrambling, will be right out of business when people are no longer forced against their will to pay for them or to attend them. And, the culture that the bureaucrats breed in the government-run indoctrination centers, they say, that not just being soft on bullying, but promoting bullying in a lot of different ways, such as treating the football players like they're better than everybody else. Mm. The teachers openly, institutionally do this. I remember when I was a hostage at a government-run indoctrination center at a junior high school being forced to attend a pep rally. I'm supposed to care whether Central Junior High School's football team defeats South Junior High School's football team.
Were you wearing your rebel flag cape?
Oh, yes, I was.
Okay, that could have caused a problem.
Well, that's okay. I'm causing a problem now.
Okay.
Because the way I was treated, they violate five of my constitutional rights.
Five of them?
So
give me one.
Five of them.
Give me the first one they violated.
My rights of mankind.
That's not in the Constitution, is it?
It is over here in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
Also, Section 7, my freedom
of speech.
It's
in most state constitutions. Gotcha. Something about power comes from the people.
I see.
Or how about this one? Let's see here. Neither the Commonwealth nor any of its subdivisions shall
Democratic Party is neither the Commonwealth nor the subdivision.
It's a political party.
Actually,
correct. It's a private entity.
Well, here's the thing. So I got angry.
What did they do? Wait. What did they do? I mean, you're claiming they violated your rights, but you haven't said exactly what they did.
Well, because you're trying to figure it out. I can just tell you. I go in there and, I was invited. And see, first of all, this was an ass-kissing session.
Right, but what did they do? So you got invited, you showed up, you were wearing a rebel flag, and then what happened?
Well, let's see here. Somebody said to me, oh, that's not going to fly here.
Mm-mm.
What, you're flying on your back? I said, excuse me? Take it off.
When I worked as a corrections officer, they didn't say, hey, Daryl,
yeah,
this isn't the real badge. This is the fake one in case one of the inmates steals it. When I worked security and I had a little badge, they never said, this is the fake badge in case somebody steals your uniform.
And the fact is, cops love their badges. So the idea that there would be a class of police officer in Pennsylvania, which, oh, no, sorry, you don't get a badge.
All right.
All the other cops get badges, but not you, Mr. Deputy. You're just a deputy.
Here's what I found out. And there are various reasons why one can be deputized.
Okay.
When I worked, I've mentioned before, working hospital security when I lived in Pennsylvania, I was deputized in La Trobe, Pennsylvania for the purposes of writing parking tickets on hospital property.
I see. Just for that,
that
sole
was
purpose.
The extent of my deputization, but there was some, you know, yep, thing of you got to swear an oath, something, something. So on this candidate forum thing, it
did
wasn't
you find
a candidate
it?
Forum.
You did find something on the 15th in that town?
Yes, the Monroe County, Pennsylvania Democratic Party had a county meeting for the purposes of signing petitions to get candidates on the ballot. The North Korean activist group says that nearly 2,000 have left Canada, some of those forcefully or under force from the Canadian government. The Canadian Border Services Agency says that they've only recorded 165 removals, which means that many people probably left voluntarily before they were forcefully removed.
Okay, well, you know, that is not as
That's
bad
why
as
I
it
used the
been.
Term voluntarily with the air quotes there.
Right. I mean, now that does mean they could go somewhere else besides back to North Korea, I suppose. So maybe Uruguay, for instance, which is one of the more friendly places, as I understand it, to immigrants from around the world. They basically don't really have much of an immigration process there. That's what I've been told. The
right. They
basic
have
level of research
something that is akin to open borders.
Yeah.
But yet the anti-open border people say, you're not really a country if you have open border. Well, I don't know anybody that says that Uruguay is not actually a country.
Well, right. I mean, there are certainly people who there are operating something that they call a government.
Yes.
And that government has jurisdiction, according to their mind, over a certain plot of land that most people will call Uruguay. But even if they really did have open borders, it's unlikely that the countries surrounding them would believe in those open borders. So there would still be a border there. It would just be the other country's border at that point.
Correct.
And so your freedom would end at the beginning where their border starts. As somebody who just recently spent some time crossing these international boundaries, it's just all so stupid. All of the waiting, all of the lines, all of the paperwork, it's just so dumb. I'm sorry, it's all for obedience, it's all for control, it's all for revenue. It has absolutely nothing to do with protecting you from anything. I mean, you've got the this propaganda out there about the people of Mexico, for instance, which is where I went to for those
right.
just tuning in. I was down in Acapulco for the Anarchapulco 2018 conference, and just before we left, I don't know if you were on this show, Daryl, but one of our listeners contacted us saying, the New York State Department has just issued a warning saying do not travel to the Guerrero province of Mexico or the Guerrero state, specifically Acapulco, because scary, because murders.
I remember
danger.
Hearing you talk about this, and you reached yeah. out to Angel Clark,
who lives
hosts
there.
A show on the Liberty Radio Network.
Yep.
She lives there.
And has for a few years now.
And yeah. she said, there's nothing going on here.
No, nothing unusual for a city of a million people. I mean, you put a million people together, there's going to be some crime.
Did you eat street food?
So we had tacos and such, which there are taquerias everywhere in Acapulco, and it's sort of a Mexican thing. There's different, you know, styles in different areas of Mexico.
Right, but did you get food? So by street food, I mean, did you order from a...
Like a cart?
A food truck or a cart?
They actually had food trucks apparently nearby the hotel, but no, not in old Acapulco or like regular Acapulco. I did not, but there are, as I said, taquerias, which are more stationary,
right.
But also excellent, very cheap, very good food that me and Laura, which is Mark's wife, and Mark all went out to eat at one of these places. And for a full dinner for the three of us, including two beers for Mark, it was $20 US. That's what
yeah.
it came to. So very, very affordable. Whereas if you go to the hotel buffet, it's $20 a head.
Yeah.
So big, big difference there. And anyway, the point I was making, though, was that the U.S. State Department comes out with this scary notice about the Guerrero province in Acapulco, which is where Acapulco is, the southwest area.
State.
They're
states in Mexico.
The Guerrero state coming out with a scary notice about how dangerous it is and don't travel. We suggest you not travel there at all. And they do this constantly about Mexico, making it sound like some sort of dangerous place, that you're in a high risk area if you go anywhere in Mexico. Just don't do it. And I think that part of that is to put into people's heads the idea that, ooh, there's bad people down there. It's a scary place, so we don't want those people coming here.
Hey, Daily Digest listeners, this is Riley Blake. I enjoy Free Talk Live, and I know you do too, but finding time to listen to an entire episode isn't always easy, so I produce the Daily Digest. I appreciate those of you who have supported me on Patreon and sent Bitcoin to me to thank me for producing these digests. For those who wish to support me on Patreon, visit patreon.com/crblake86. If you wish to send Bitcoin, visit patreon.com/crblake86 for those details. That's patreon.com/crblake86. Thank you.
I'd asked Daryl, and you did a little bit of digging there to see if the State Department, that's putting out all kinds of scary warnings about Mexico's states, do they also go ahead and warn people about visiting their own states or their own cities, like Chicago, one of the most murdering cities in the United States right now?
Not that I was able to find.
No, okay, I didn't think so.
I did notice, and they actually have a list of basically every country with a level 1, 2, 3, or 4. Level 4 is do not travel. Level 3 is reconsider. Level 2 is exercise increased caution. And level 1 is exercise normal precautions.
Okay.
Yemen is a do not travel. Level 4, do not travel. Which scary. I wouldn't recommend traveling to Yemen either, but for different reasons than what the State Department
says. Any places
says.
Where bombs are dropping is probably not a real safe place to travel.
Right.
That's not happening in Acapulco.
Correct. For Yemen, they say do not travel to Yemen due to terrorism, civil unrest, health, and armed conflict. Yeah. They don't mention anywhere in here that the U.S. government is helping the Saudi government bomb the living S out of Yemen.
We reported last year how much weight the average Venezuelan had lost in 2016, and I think it was like 17 pounds.
Think it was 19. Yeah. 75% of Venezuelans lost at least 19 pounds, which means the average, you know, is going to be slightly different from that. But 75% lost at least 19 pounds.
In 2017, according to the latest numbers, Venezuelans reported losing on average 24 pounds in body weight last year. And almost 90% now live in poverty, according to a new university study on the impact of a devastating economic crisis and food shortages. The annual survey, published on Wednesday by three universities, is one of the most closely followed assessments of Venezuelans' well-being amid a government information vacuum and shows a steady rise in poverty and hunger in recent years. Over 60% of Venezuelans surveyed said that during the previous 3 months, they had woken up hungry because they didn't have enough money to buy food. About a quarter of the population was eating two or fewer meals per day, the study showed. Last year, three universities found that the Venezuelans said they'd lost an average of 8 kilograms during 2016. Just to clarify, this year it's 11 kilograms. So you're talking about almost a 50% increase in loss, if you want to call it that way. Wednesday's study flagged Venezuelans' deteriorating diets. Income is being pulverized, said Maria Ponce, one of the study's investigators. She told a news conference at the Andres Bello Catholic University on Caracas's outskirts. Quote, this disparity between the rise in prices and the population's salaries is so generalized that there's practically not a single Venezuelan who is not poor. They said that basically 90% of Venezuela is now in poverty at this point. The study calculated the poverty rate from 13 different economic indicators, such as income and access to services. If the average of these indicators was above 25%, investigators defined a person as poor. Prices rose in Venezuela 4,068% in the 12 months to the end of January, according to estimates by the country's opposition-led National Assembly. Daryl, would you mind pulling up Dollar today, and we'll get a current update. Last I saw, there was 230,000 bolivar per one U.S. dollar in the black market rates.
230,000. Yeah. Oh, wait, hold on. There's 230, 228, and then 241, 592.
That's a lot of bolivar for one U.S.
What's
dollar.
What's the difference between those two numbers again?
You'll have to read what it says. There's like a name for each one of them here.
Cambio Frontizio Dollar CUC.
The number that you want is the main number, 230,000.
Okay.
Is the main one. But either way, it's a big number, 230,000, 241,000. Who's counting?
If I only accept a $20 bill as valued at $10, that's not going to cause inflation or hyperinflation. There still has to be an action by the central bank or, you know, some government entity to print more currency.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. But I think that somebody's
mindset plays into it. But people's thoughts and actions can lead to that additional printing, but the actual increase of the money supply is the inflation.
Well, don't worry, Daryl.
And hyperinflation is when it hits a certain threshold, and I forget what that is.
They've got a plan. Don't worry. The Venezuela government has a brilliant plan to introduce, and you got to give them credit for this, the world's first state-run cryptocurrency. Now, it's going to be awful because it's state-run. You know, there's just no way that it could be anything but
awful. It's going to be an Ethereum token. Of course it's going to be awful.
No, it's not. They're launching their own currency. I believe what you're referring to is the ICO. So first, as I understand it, now, I could be wrong.
Right, the ICO.
That's on the Ethereum.
You buy an Ethereum token.
Correct.
And then like 90-some-odd% of other ICOs, they're never actually going to develop their own blockchain.
If you've lost 18 pounds 1 year and then 24 pounds the next year, there's not much left inside you at that
point. Right, and that's why I was saying, and you were talking about the fact, and we discussed this a couple of weeks ago, that there were people stopping trucks that were delivering food and then stealing the food. And
very dangerous.
You know, I pointed out, you know, when you're starving, you know, you're not necessarily concerned about, you know, property rights.
No.
And your morality sort of goes out the window because you go into survival mode.
This is one of those things where the non-aggression principle kind of breaks down a little bit, right? Where we've talked about in a situation in which, let's say it's a natural disaster. I think that's usually the context in which it's come up here, because people generally aren't starving in the United States and under most circumstances.
Right.
But in a natural disaster situation where there is no food available, is it wrong to, you know, somebody else has already smashed the storefront window, there's bread all over the place, do you take a loaf of bread in order to sustain yourself? And the best answer I could come up with in that circumstance would be that the intention would be to pay it back later.
Right. So
there's
the question of, is it morally wrong, but also, is it understandable?
Yeah.
Some Ethereum tokens, I don't know how many of them, but I do know that some Ethereum tokens are themselves listed on exchanges.
That's true. Yep.
So you don't necessarily have to exchange the token for Ethereum necessarily. You know, you might, depending on the exchange, have to do that before exchanging to Tether or something else that you convert to your native currency.
You don't get the Petro token without exchanging Ethereum first. So if you want to get the token, you have to get
Ethereum. Once you have
the token,
a Petro token.
But
the Venezuelan government, they're receiving the Ethereum, so they can just exchange that.
Correct.
Yeah.
And they can turn the Ethereum into whatever they want to turn it into, including, like I said, dollars.
So that they can pay the printing companies that they owe millions of dollars to?
$70 million as of the last time we checked.
And I think that was just to one of the printers.
Correct. I suspect they didn't use more than one at that time, but I bet you they moved to a different company since that one printer was refusing to accept any more business from them from that point forward. So we're going to watch this Petro supposed cryptocurrency pretty closely here and see what happens.
And you mentioned that according to some source, they've sold $735 million U.S. dollars worth of this thing.
In day number one on Tuesday.
I found an article from the Economic Gazette that says that Maduro did not give details of the original investors and no evidence was provided for his statement about the amount of money raised.
A last-minute blockchain switch has seen scammers trying to cash in on confusion. Headline, Venezuela's Petro launch was amateur hour. On Tuesday, Venezuela completed the first phase in launching its first ever state-issued and oil-backed crypto currency called the Petro, and it got weird. A Petro token was released in a pre-sale stage using a different technology than was stated in the white paper. This change was effectively announced without any fanfare in a Petro buyer's manual that the Venezuelan government released on Tuesday. The Petro White Paper, an important document that lays out the technical foundations of a cryptocurrency, initially had stated the Petro token would exist on the Ethereum blockchain. And that's what we've been claiming all night long here.
Right, because I read the white paper.
And that it would be coded as a smart contract, but it was actually released as an asset on NEM. This opened the door for scammers to try and cash in on the confusion. NEM, short for New Economy Movement, is a blockchain that's been around since 2015 and is secured by a allegedly more egalitarian, compared to Bitcoin and Ethereum, proof of importance algorithm that selects miners based on how much NEM they have rather than how much capital they own in terms of computers and money to pay for electricity.
So proof of importance is basically a different term for proof of stake.
First I've heard of it, but I'd say that sounds like a possible definition for it. The government agency that's launching this Petro token decided, oh, well, we've been saying and putting in our white paper that's going to be an Ethereum token, which is pretty much where all the tokens are, right, is on the Ethereum blockchain. But now it's an NEM asset type, which I guess is different from a token somehow. I don't know anything about NEM.
Basically, asset is the NEM token. Term for token.
Okay. I've never looked into NEM. I saw that it was like a Chinese crypto or something like that, and it seemed to be – maybe I don't even know anything about it, but it's one of the top 10 right now, isn't it, NEM?
I don't know. I've heard of it. I can try pulling that up.
But tell me about the proof of importance.
Yes.
First.
So when you mentioned proof of importance, my first question was
– what is it?
How's that different from proof of stake? So article here from Smith and Crown says proof of importance is a blockchain consensus mechanism introduced by NEM that functions similar to proof of stake, where nodes need to vest an amount of currency to be eligible for creating blocks and are selected for creating a block roughly in proportion to a score. In proof of stake, the score is one's total vested amount. So
blocks, by the way, are the portions of the blockchain that have data in them, like transaction information.
Right. So with the Dash, for instance, they have the supernodes. Masternodes, where you need like 1,000 Dash that must stay in that node. With proof of importance, the score includes more variables in addition to the amount that is in that vested thing. Other inputs for determining a score for proof of importance is the vested amount of currency for the purposes of creating blocks. And something that they call cluster nodes, accounts that are part of interlinked clusters of activity, are weighted slightly more heavily than outliers or hubs, which simply link clusters but aren't actually part of them.
Okay.
They say the importance score addresses two primary criticisms of proof of stake. One risk is that people simply hoard as many coins as possible to reap rewards. This concentration of wealth will discourage transactions. The important score means that hoarding will result in a lower score because,
you get a higher score if you spend.
The recent transactions get weighted more heavily than other transactions, and the number of transactions you've had counts towards your score in proof of importance. They say the second risk is the nothing at stake problem. Because block creation costs no resources. Whenever there's a fork, someone can freely create blocks on both forks. This will greatly, perhaps indefinitely, prolong the fork. NEM's proof of importance guards against that.
You just heard highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. You can download full episodes, subscribe to our podcast, listen live, and more, all for free at freetalklive.com.